Hawkin stared at her aghast as she led him into a set of couples.
"Who are you?" he whispered. "Are you an old one?"
"Not for all the world,"
said Maggie Barnes in the old speech, and Hawkin turned quite white and stood still. She laughed softly and said in English,
"No more of that. Dance, or people will notice. It's easy enough. Watch the next man as the music begins."
Hawkin, pale and distressed, stumbled his way through the first part of the dance. Gradually he picked up the steps. Merriman said in Will's ear,
"He was told that not one soul here would know of him, and that on pain of death he must not use the old speech to any but you."
Then the speaking below began again.
"You look well, Hawkin, for a man escaped from death. How do you know these things, girl? Who are you? They would have let you die, Hawkin. How could you be so stupid?"
"My master loves me," said Hawkin, but there was weakness in it.
"He used you, Hawkin. You were nothing to him. You should follow better masters who would care for your life and lengthen it through the centuries, not confine it to your own.
Like the life of an old one,"
Hawkin said, eagerness waking in his voice for the first time. Will remembered the tinge of envy when Hawkin had spoken to him of the old ones. Now there was a hint of greed as well.
"The dark and the rider are kinder masters than the light,"
Maggie Barnes said softly in his ear, as the first part of the dance ended. Hawkin stood still again and stared at her, until she glanced round and said clearly,
"I need a cool drink, I believe."
And Hawkin jumped and led her away, so that now, with his attention caught and a chance to talk to him privately, the girl of the dark would have a willing hearer. Will felt suddenly sickened by the approaching treachery, and listened no more. He found Merriman beside him, still gazing black into space.
"So it will go," Merriman said. "He will have a sweet picture of the dark to attract him, as men so often do, and beside it he will set all the demands of the light, which are heavy and always will be. All the while he will be nursing his resentment of the way I might have had him give up his life without reward. You can be sure the dark makes no sign of demanding any such thing. Yet. Indeed, its lords never risk demanding death, but only offer a black life."
"Hawkin," he said softly, bleakly, "liege man, how can you do what you are going to do?"
Will felt fear suddenly, and Merriman sensed it.
"No more of this," he said. "It is clear already how it goes. Hawkin now will be a leak in the roof, a tunnel into the cellar. And just as the dark could not touch him when he was my liege man, now that he is liege to the dark, he cannot be destroyed by the light. He will be the dark's ear in our midst, in this house that has been our stronghold."
His voice was cold, accepting the inevitable. The pain was gone. Though the witch girl managed to make her way in, she could have accomplished no scrap of magic without being destroyed by the light. But now, whenever Hawkin calls them, the dark can attack us here as elsewhere, and the danger will grow with the years. He stood up, fingering his white ruffled cravat. There was a terrible sternness in his fierce curved profile, and the look that for a moment flared out from the lowering brows made Will's blood run thick and slow. It was a judge's face, implacable, condemning.
"And the doom that Hawkin has brought upon himself by this act," Merriman said without expression, "is a dread matter, which will make him many times wish that he might die."
Will stood dazed, caught in pity and alarm. He did not ask what would happen to small, bright-eyed Hawkin, who had laughed at him and helped him and been for so short a while his friend. He did not want to know. Out on the floor, the music of the second part of the dance jingled to a close, and the dancers made one another laughing courtesies. Will stood motionless and unhappy. Merriman's frozen look softened, and he reached out and turned him gently to face the center of the room. Will saw there only a gap in the crowd, with beyond it the group of musicians. As he stood there, they struck up once more Good King Wenceslas, the carol they had been playing when first he entered the room, through the doors. Merrily the whole gathering joined in singing, and then the next verse came, and Merriman's deep voice was ringing out across the room, and Will realized, blinking, that the verse to come was his. He drew breath and raised his head. "Sire, he lives a good league hence, underneath the mountain." And there was no moment of farewell, no moment in which he saw the 19th century vanish away. But suddenly, with no awareness of change, as he sang, he knew that time had somehow blinked, and another young voice was singing with him, the two of them so nearly simultaneous that anyone who could not see the lips moving would have sworn that it was one boy's voice alone. "Right against the forest fence, by St. Agnes Far Auntane." And he knew that he was standing with James and Mary and the rest, and he and James were singing together, and that the music with their voices was Paul's lone flute. He stood there in the dark entrance hall, with his hands raised before his chest, holding the lighted candle, and he saw that the candle had not burned down 1 millimeter further than when he had last looked at it. They finished the carol. Miss Graythorne said,
"Very good, very good indeed. Nothing like Good King Wenceslas. It's always been my favourite."
Will peered past his candle flame to look at her motionless form in the big carved chair. Her voice was older, harder, more toughened by the years, and so was her face. But otherwise she was just like her grandmother. Must that younger Miss Graythorne have been, or her great-grandmother? Miss Graythorne said,
"Huntercombe carol singers have been singing Good King Wenceslas in this house for longer than you or even I can remember, you know. Well now, Paul and Robin and the rest of you, how about a little Christmas punch?"
The question was traditional, and so was the answer.
"Well," said Robin gravely, "thank you, Miss Graythorne, perhaps just a little."
"Even young Will, too, this year," said Paul. "He's 11 now, Miss Graythorne, did you know?"
The housekeeper was coming forward with a tray of glittering glasses and a great bowl of red-brown punch, and nearly every eye in the room was on Merriman stepping up to fill the glasses. But Will's gaze was held by the strong, suddenly younger eyes of the figure in the high-backed chair.
"Yes," said Miss Graythorne, softly, almost absent-mindedly. "I did remember. Will Stanton has had a birthday."
She turned to Merriman, who was already moving towards them, and took from him the two glasses in his hands.
"A happy birthday to you, Will Stanton. Seventh son of a seventh son," said Miss Graythorne. "And success in your every quest."
"Thank you, ma'am," said Will, wondering.
And they held up their glasses solemnly to one another and drank, just as the Stanton children did for the Christmas toast on the one day of the year when they were all allowed wine at dinner. Merriman was moving round, and now everyone had a glass of punch and was sipping contentedly. The Manor's Christmas punch was always delicious, though no one had ever quite worked out what went into it. As the senior members of the family, the twins strolled dutifully across to chat with Miss Graythorne. Barbara, with Mary in tow, made a beeline for Miss Hampton, the housekeeper, and Annie the maid, both reluctant members of a village drama group she was trying to force into life. Merriman said to James,
"You and your little brother sing very well."
James beamed. Though plumper, he was no taller than Will, and it was not often that a stranger gratified him by recognizing him as a superior, older brother.
"We sing in the school choir," he said, "and solos at arts festivals, even one in London last year. The music master's very keen on arts festivals."
"I'm not," said Will, "all those mothers glaring."
"Well, you were top of your class in London," James said, "so of course they all hated you, beating their little darlings."
I was only fifth in mine," he said in matter-of-fact tones to Merriman. "Will has a lot better voice than me."
"Oh, come off it," said Will.
"Yes, you have."
James was a fair-minded boy. He genuinely preferred reality to daydreams.
"Till we both break, at any rate. Neither of us might be any good then."
Merriman said absent-mindedly,
"In point of fact, you will become a most accomplished tenor, almost professional standard. Your brother's voice will be baritone, pleasant, but nothing special."
"Well, I suppose that might be possible," said James, polite but disbelieving. "Of course, there's no way at all for anyone to tell. Yet."
Will said belligerently,
"But he—"
and caught Merriman's dark eye and stopped.
"Ah," he said,
and James looked at him with astonishment. Miss Graythorne called across the room to Merriman.
"Paul would like to see the old recorders and flutes. Take him in, would you?"
Merriman inclined his head in a small bow. He said casually to Will and James, "Care to come too?"
"No, thank you," said James promptly.
His eyes were on the far door, through which the housekeeper was advancing with another tray.
"I smell Miss Hampton's mince pies,"
Will said, understanding.
"I quite like to see."
He moved with Merriman towards Miss Graythorne's chair, where Paul and Robin stood stiff and rather awkward, one at each side, like guardsmen.
"Off with you," said Miss Graythorne briskly. "Are you going too, Will? Of course, you're another musical one, I was forgetting. Quite a good little collection of instruments and stuff in there. Surprise you haven't seen them before."
Lulled by the words, Will said thoughtlessly,
"In the library."
Miss Graythorne's sharp eyes glittered at him.
"The library?" she said. "You must be mixing us up with someone else, Will. There's no library here. Once there was a small one with some most valuable books, I believe, but it burned down almost a century ago. This part of the house was struck by lightning. Did a lot of damage, they say." "Oh, dear," said Will in some confusion. "Well, this is no talk for Christmas," Miss Graythorne said, and waved them off.
Glancing back at her, as she turned to Robin with a bright social smile, Will found himself wondering whether the two Miss Graythornes were not one after all. Merriman led him, with Paul, to a side door, and they walked through a strange, musty-smelling little passage into a high, bright room that Will did not at once recognize. It was only when he caught sight of the fireplace that he realized where he was. There was the wide hearth, and the broad mantel with its square panels and carved Tudor rose emblems. But round the rest of the room the panelling was gone. The walls were instead painted flat white, and brightened here and there by some large, improbable-looking seascapes done in lurid blues and greens. In the place where Will had once gone into the little library, there was no longer any door. Merriman was unlocking a tall, glass-fronted cabinet that stood against a side wall.
"Miss Graythorne's father was a very musical gentleman," he said in his butler voice, "and artistic, too. He painted all those pictures on the walls over there. In the West Indies, I believe. These, though..." He lifted out a small, beautiful instrument, like a recorder, black inlaid with silver. "He didn't actually play, they say. He just liked to look at them."
Paul was absorbed at once, peering at, into, through the old flutes and recorders as Merriman handed them out of the cupboard. They were both most solemn in their handling. They would put each one carefully back before taking the next out. Will turned to study the panels round the fireplace, then jumped suddenly as he heard Merriman silently calling to him. At the same time, he could hear Merriman's voice aloud speaking to Paul. It was an eerie combination.
"Quickly now," said the voice in his mind. "You know where to look. Quick, while you have the chance. It is time to take the sign."
"But,"
said Will's mind.
"Go on,"
Merriman silently roared. Will glanced back quickly over his shoulder. The door through which they had come was still half open, but his ears would surely warn him of anyone coming up the passage between this room and the next. He moved soft-footed to the fireplace, reached up, and put his hand on the panelling. Shutting his eyes for an instant, he appealed to all his new gifts, and the old world from which they came. Which square panel had it been? Which carved rose? He was confused by the loss of the panelled wall all around. The mantel seemed smaller than before. Was the sign lost, bricked up somewhere behind that flat white wall? He pressed every rose that he could see round the top left-hand corner of the fireplace, but none moved even a fraction of an inch.
Then, at the last moment, he noticed, at the very point of the corner, a rose part buried in plaster, jutting out of the wall, that clearly had been repaired as well as altered in the last 100 years. 10 minutes, he thought wildly, since he had last seen it. Hastily, Will reached up high and pressed his thumb as hard as he could against the centre of the carved flower, as if it were a bell-push. And as he heard the soft click, he was staring into a black square hole in the wall, exactly on the level of his eyes. He reached in and touched the circle of the sign of wood, and as he sighed in relief, his fingers closing round the smooth wood, he heard Paul begin to play one of the old flutes. It was very tentative playing, a slow arpeggio first, then a hesitant run, and then, very softly and gently, Paul began playing the melody Greensleeves. And Will stood transfixed, not only by the lovely lilt of the old tune, but by the sound of the instrument itself. For though the melody was different, this was his music, his enchantment, the same eerie, faraway tone that he heard always, and then always lost, at those moments in his life that mattered most. What was the nature of this flute that his brother was playing? Was it part of the old ones, belonging to their magic, or simply something very like, made by men? He drew his hand back from the gap in the wall, which closed instantly before he could press the rose again, and he was sliding the sign of wood into his pocket as he turned, lost in listening. And then he froze. Paul stood playing across the room beside the cabinet. Merriman had his back turned and his hands on the glass doors. But now the room held two other figures as well. In the doorway through which they had come stood Maggie Barnes, staring not at Will but at Paul with a look of dreadful malevolence. And close beside Will, very close, in the spot where the door to the old library had once been, towered the Black Rider. He was within arm's length of Will, though he did not move but stood transfixed as if the music had arrested him in mid-stride. His eyes were closed, his lips silently moving. His hands were stretched out, pointing ominously towards Paul as the sweet, unearthly music went on. Will did one thing well from the instinct of his new learning. Instantly he flung up a wall of resistance round Merriman and Paul and himself, so that the two of the dark swayed backward from the force of it. But at the same time he shrieked, "Merriman!" And as the music broke off, and both Paul and Merriman swung round in swift horror, he knew what he had done wrong. He had not called as the old one should call one another through the mind. He had made the very bad mistake of shouting aloud. The rider and Maggie Barnes vanished instantly. Paul was striding across the room in concern. "What on earth's up, Will? Did you hurt yourself?" Merriman said swiftly, smoothly, from behind him, "He stumbled, I think." And Will had the wit to crease his face with pain, bend slowly over as if in anguish, and clutch hard at one arm. There was the sound of running feet, and Robin burst into the room from the passage, with Barbara close behind. "What's the matter? We heard the most awful yell." He looked at Will and slowed to a halt, puzzled. "You're right, Will."
Said Will. I just banged my funny bone. Sorry, it hurt."
"Sounded as if someone was murdering you," Barbara said reproachfully. Shamelessly, Will took refuge in rudeness, his fingers curling in his pocket to make sure the third sign was safe. "Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you," he said petulantly, "but really I'm all right. I just banged myself and yelled, that's all. Sorry if you were frightened. I don't see what all the fuss is about."
Robin glared at him. "Catch me running anywhere to rescue you next time," he said witheringly.
"Talk about the boy crying wolf," Barbara said.
"I think," Merriman said gently, closing the cupboard and turning the key, "that we should all go and give Miss Greythorne one more carol."
And quite forgetting that he was no more than the butler, they all filed dutifully out of the room in his wake. Will called after him in proper silence this time.
"But I must speak to you. The rider was here, and the girl."
Merriman said into his mind,
"I know. Later. They have ways of hearing this kind of talk, remember?"
And he moved on, leaving Will twitching with exasperation and alarm. In the doorway, Paul paused, took Will firmly by the shoulder, and turned him to look in his face.
"Are you really all right?"
"Honest. Sorry about the noise.
That flute sounded super.
Fantastic thing.
Paul let him go, turning to gaze longingly at the cupboard.
Really, I've never heard anything like it. And of course never played one. You've no idea, Will. I can't describe. It's tremendously old, and yet the condition it's in, it might be almost new. And the tone of it.
There was an ache in his voice and his face that something in Will responded to with a deep, ancient sympathy. An old one, he suddenly knew, was doomed always to feel this same formless, nameless longing for something out of reach, as an endless part of life.
I'd give anything, Paul said, to have a flute like that one day.
Almost anything,
Will said gently.
Paul stared at him in astonishment, and the old one in Will suddenly realized belatedly that this was not perhaps the response of a small boy. So he grinned, stuck out his tongue impishly at Paul, and skipped through the passage back to the normal relationships of the normal world. They sang the First Noel as their last carol. They made their farewells. They were out again in the snow and the crisp air, with Merriman's impassive, polite smile disappearing behind the manor doors. Will stood on the broad stone steps and gazed up at the stars. The clouds had cleared at last, and now the stars blazed like pinpricks of white fire in the black hollow of the night sky, in all the strange patterns that had been a complicated mystery to him all his life, but were endlessly significant now.
"See how bright the Pleiades are tonight," he said softly. And Mary stared at him in amazement and said, "The what?"
So Will brought his attention down out of the fiery black heavens, and in their own small, yellow, torch-lit world, the Stanton carolers trooped home. He walked among them, speechless, as if in a dream. They thought him tired, but he was floating in wonder. He had three of the signs of power now. He had, too, the knowledge to use the gift of gramarye, a long lifetime of discovery and wisdom given to him in a moment of suspended time. He was not the same Will Stanton that he had been a very few days before. Now and forever, he knew, he inhabited a different timescale from that of everyone he had ever known or loved. But he managed to turn his thoughts away from all these things, even from the two invading, threatening figures of the dark. For this was Christmas, which had always been a time of magic to him and to all the world. This was a brightness, a shining festival, and while its enchantment was on the world, the charmed circle of his family and home would be protected against any invasion from outside. Indoors the tree glowed and glittered, and the music of Christmas was in the air, and spicy smells came from the kitchen, and in the broad hearth of the living room the great twisted Yule root flickered and flamed as it gently burned down. Will lay on his back on the hearth rug, staring into the smoke wreathing up the chimney, and was suddenly very sleepy indeed. James and Mary, too, were trying not to yawn, and even Robin looked heavy-lidded.
"Too much punch," said James, as his tall brother stretched gaping in an armchair.
"Get lost," said Robin amiably.
"Who'd like a mince pie?"
said Mrs. Stanton, coming in with a vast tray of cocoa mugs.
"James has had six already,"
said Mary in prim disapproval.
"At the manor."
"Now it's eight," said James, a mince pie in each hand. "Yah! You'll get fat," Robin said.
"Better than being fat already," James said, through a mouthful, and stared pointedly at Mary, whose plump form had recently become her most gloomy preoccupation. Mary's mouth drooped, then tightened, and she advanced on him, making a snarling sound.
"Ho, ho, ho," said Will sepulchrally from the floor. "Good little children, never fight at Christmas."
And since Mary was irresistibly close to him, he grabbed her by the ankle. She collapsed on top of him, howling cheerfully.
"Mind the fire,"
said Mrs. Stanton from years of habit.
"Ow!"
said Will, as his sister thumped him in the stomach, and he rolled away out of reach. Mary stopped and sat gazing at him curiously.
"Why on earth have you got so many buckles on your belt?" she demanded.
Will tucked his sweater hastily down over his belt, but it was too late. Everyone had seen. Mary reached forward and yanked the sweater up again.
"What funny things. What are they?"
"Just decoration," Will said gruffly. "I made them in metalwork at school."
"I never saw you," said James.
"Well, you never looked then." Mary prodded a finger forward at the first circle on Will's belt and rolled back with a howl.
It burned me,
she shrieked.
Very probably, said her mother. Will and his belt have both been lying next to the fire.
And you'll both be on top of it if you go on rolling about like that. Come on now, Christmas Eve drink, Christmas Eve mince pie, Christmas Eve bed. Will scrambled gratefully to his feet.
I'll get my presents while the cocoa cools off.
So will I, Mary followed him. On the stairs, she said,
those buckle things are pretty.
Will you make me one for a brooch next term?
I might,
Will said, and he grinned to himself. Mary's curiosity was never much to worry about. It always led to the same place. They pounded up to their respective bedrooms and came down laden with packages to be added to the growing pile beneath the tree. Will had been trying hard not to look at this magical heap ever since they came in from carol singing, but it was sorely difficult, especially since he could see one gigantic box labelled with a name that clearly began with a W. Who else began with a W, after all? He forced himself to ignore it and resolutely piled his own armful in a space at the side of the tree.
"You're watching, James,"
Mary shrilled behind him.
"I'm not," said James.
Then he said, because it was Christmas Eve,
"Well, yes, I expect I was. Sorry."
And Mary was so taken aback that she deposited all her parcels in silence, unable to think of anything to say. On Christmas night, Will always slept with James. Both twin beds were still in James's room from the time before Will had moved up to Stephen's attic. The only difference now was that James kept Will's old bed piled with op-art cushions and referred to it as my chaise longue. There was something about Christmas Eve, they both felt, that demanded company. One needed somebody to whisper to during the warm, beautiful, dream-taught moments between hanging the empty stocking at the end of the bed and dropping into the cosy oblivion that would flower into the marvel of Christmas morning. While James was splashing in the bathroom, Will slipped off his belt, buckled it again round the three signs, and put them under his pillow. It seemed prudent, even though he still knew without question that no one and nothing would trouble him or his home during this night. Tonight, perhaps for the last time, he was an ordinary boy again. Strands of music and the soft rumble of voices drifted up from below. In solemn ritual, Will and James looped their Christmas stockings over their bedposts. Precious, unbeautiful brown stockings of a thick, soft stuff, worn by their mother in some unimaginably distant time, and misshapen now by years of service as Christmas hold-alls. When filled, they would become top-heavy and could no longer hang. They would be discovered instead lying magnificent across the foot of the beds.
"Bet I know what Mum and Dad are giving you," James said softly. "Bet it's a..." "Don't you dare,"
Will hissed, and his brother giggled and dived under the blankets.
"Good night, Will." "Night. Happy Christmas. Happy Christmas."
And it was the same as it always was, as he lay curled up happily in his snug wrappings, promising himself that he would stay awake until he woke in the dim morning room, with a glimmer of light creeping round the dark square of the curtained window, and saw and heard nothing for an enchanted expectant space, because all his senses were concentrated on the weighty feel over and around his blanketed feet, of strange bumps and corners and shapes that had not been there when he fell asleep. And it was Christmas Day. Christmas Day. When he knelt beside the Christmas tree and pulled off the gay paper wrapping from the giant box labelled Will, the first thing he discovered was that it was not a box at all, but a wooden crate. A Christmas choir warbled distant and joyful from the radio in the kitchen. It was the after-Christmas stocking, before-breakfast gathering of the family, when each member opened just one of his tree presents. The rest of the bright pile would lie there until after dinner, happily tantalizing. Will, being the youngest, had the first turn. He had made a beeline for the box, partly because it was so impressively large, and partly because he suspected it came from Stephen. He found that someone had taken the nails out of the wooden lid, so that he could open it easily.
"Robin pulled out the nails, and Bar and I put the paper on," said Mary at his shoulder, all agog. "But we didn't look inside. Come on, Will, come on."
He took off the lid.
"It's full of dead leaves, or reeds, or something."
"Palm leaves," said his father, looking. For packing, I suppose. Mind your fingers, they can have sharp edges. Will tugged out handfuls of the rustling fronds until the first hard shape of something began to show. It was a thin, strange, curving shape, brown, smooth, like a branch. It seemed to be made of a hard kind of papier-mâché. It was an antler, like and yet not like the antler of a deer. Will paused suddenly. A strong and totally unexpected feeling had leapt out at him when he touched the antler. It was not a feeling he had ever had in the presence of the family before. It was the mixture of excitement, security, and delight that came over him whenever he was with one of the old ones. He saw an envelope poking out of the packing beside the antler and opened it. That paper bore the neat letterhead of Stephen's ship. Dear Will, happy birthday, happy Christmas. I always swore never to combine the two, didn't I? And here I am doing it. Let me tell you why. I don't know whether you'll understand, especially after you see what the present is, but perhaps you will. You've always been a bit different from everybody else. I don't mean daft, just different. It was like this. I was in the oldest part of Kingston one day during Carnival. Carnival in these islands is a very special time, great fun with echoes going back a long, long way. Anyway, I got mixed up in a procession, all laughing people and jingling steel bands and dancers in wild costumes, and I met an old man. He was a very impressive old man, his skin very black and his hair very white, and he sort of appeared out of nowhere and took me by the arm and pulled me out of the dancing. I'd never seen him in my life before, anywhere, I'm sure of it. But he looked at me and he said, "You are Stephen Stanton of Her Majesty's Navy. I have something for you. Not for you yourself, but for your youngest brother, the seventh son. You will send it to him as a present, for his birthday this year and his Christmas combined in one. It will be a gift from you, his brother, and he will know what to do with it in due course, although you will not." It was all so unexpected, it really knocked me off balance. All I could say was, "But who are you? How do you know me?" And the old man just looked at me again with very dark, deep eyes that seemed to be looking through me into the day after tomorrow, and he said, "I would know you anywhere. You are Will Stanton's brother." There is a look that we old ones have. Our families have something of it, too. And that was about it, Will. He didn't say another word. That last bit makes no sense, I know, but that was what he said. Then he just moved into the carnival procession and out again. And when he came out, he was wearing, actually, the thing you will find in this box. So here I am sending it to you, just as I was told. It seems mad, and I can think of lots of things you'd have liked better. But there it is. There was something extraordinary about that old man, and I just somehow had to do what he told me. Hope you like your crazy present, mate. I'll be thinking of you both days. Love, Stephen. Slowly, Will folded the letter and put it back in its envelope. A look that we old ones have. So the circle stretched all the way round the world. But of course it did. There would be no point in it otherwise. He was glad to have Stephen part of the pattern. It was right, somehow. "Oh, come on, Will!" Mary was hopping with curiosity, her dressing gown flapping. "Open it, open it!" Will suddenly realized that his tradition-minded family had been standing, patiently immobile, waiting for 5 minutes while he read his letter. Using the lid of the crate as a tray, he hastily began hauling out more and more palm-leaf packing, until finally the object inside was clear. He pulled it out, staggering as he took the weight, and everybody gasped. It was a giant carnival head, brilliant and grotesque. The colours were bright and crude, the features boldly made and easily recognisable, all done in the same smooth, light substance like papier-mâché or a kind of grainless wood. And it was not the head of a man. Will had never seen anything like it before. The head from which the branching antlers sprang was shaped like the head of a stag, but the ears beside the horns were those of a dog or a wolf. And the face beneath the horns was a human face, but with the round, feather-edged eyes of a bird. There was a strong, straight human nose, a firm human mouth set in a slight smile. There was not much else that was purely human about the thing at all. The chin was bearded, but the beard so shaped that it might as easily have been the chin of a goat or deer as of a man. The face could have been frightening. When everyone had gasped, the sound Mary made and hastily muffled had been more like a small scream. But Will felt that its effect would depend on who was looking at it. The appearance was nothing. It was neither ugly nor beautiful, frightening nor funny. It was a thing made to call out deep responses from the mind. It was very much a thing of the old ones.
"My word," his father said.
"That's a funny sort of present," said James. His mother said nothing. Mary said nothing, but edged away a little.
"Reminds me of someone I know," Robin said, grinning.
Paul said nothing. Gwen said nothing. Max said softly,
"Look at those eyes."
Barbara said, "But what's it for?" Will ran his fingers over the strange great face. It took him only a moment to find what he was looking for. It was almost invisible unless you were expecting it, engraved on the forehead, between the horns. The imprint of a circle, quartered by a cross. He said, "It's a West Indian carnival head. It's old. It's special. Stephen found it in Jamaica." James was beside him now, peering up inside the head. "There's a kind of wire framework that rests on your shoulders, and a slit where the mouth's just a bit open. I suppose you look out through that. Come on, Will, put it on." He heaved up the head from behind to slip it over Will's shoulders, but Will drew away as some other part of his mind spoke silently to him. "Not now," he said. "Somebody else open their present." And Mary forgot the head and her reaction to it in the happy instant of finding that it was her turn for Christmas. She dived at the pile of presents by the tree, and the cheerful discoveries began again. One present each. They had almost done, and it was almost time for breakfast, when the knocking came at the front door. Mrs. Stanton had been about to reach for her own ritual parcel. Her arm dropped to her side, and she looked up blankly. "Who on earth can that be?" They all stared at one another and then at the door, as if it might speak. This was all wrong, like a phrase of music changing in mid-melody. Nobody ever came to the house at this hour on Christmas Day. It was not in the pattern. "I wonder," said Mr. Stanton, with a faint surmise waking in his voice. And he pushed his feet more firmly into his slippers and got up to open the front door. They heard the door open. His back filled the space and stopped them from seeing the visitor. But his voice rose in obvious pleasure.
"My dear chap, how very good of you! Come in, do come in!"
And as he turned back towards the living room, he was holding a small package in one hand that had not been there before, clearly a product of the tall figure that now loomed in the doorway, following him in. Mr. Stanton was beaming and glowing, busy with introductions.
"Alice, love, this is Mr. Mitoffin. So kind, all this way on Christmas morning, just to deliver. Shouldn't have taken the... Mitoffin, my son Max, my daughter Gwen, James, Barbara."
Will listened without attention to the grown-up politenesses. It was only at the voice of the stranger that he glanced up. There was something familiar in the deep, slightly nasal voice with a trace of accent, carefully repeating the names.
"How do you do, Mrs. Stanton? Compliments of the season to you, Max, Gwen."
And Will saw the outline of the face and the longish red-brown hair, and he froze. It was the rider. This Mr. Mitoffin, his father's friend from goodness knows where, was the black rider from somewhere outside time. Will seized the nearest thing to his hand, a sweep of bright cloth that was Stephen's present from Jamaica to his sister Barbara, and pulled it quickly over the carnival head to mask it from view. As he turned again, the rider raised his head to look further back into the room and saw him. He stared at Will in open, triumphant challenge, a small smile on his lips. Mr. Stanton beckoned, flapping a hand.
"Will, come here a minute. My youngest son, Mr.—"
Will was instantly a furious old one, so furious that he did not pause to think what he should do. He could feel every inch of himself as if he had grown in his rage to 3 times his own height. He stretched out his right hand with its fingers spread stiff towards his family and saw them instantly caught into a stop in time, frozen out of all movement. Like waxworks, they stood stiff and motionless round the room.
"How dare you come in here!"
he shouted at the rider. The two of them stood facing one another across the room, the only living and moving objects there. No human moved. The hands of the clock on the mantelpiece did not move, and though the flames of the fire flickered, they did not consume the logs that they burned.
"How dare you! At Christmas! On Christmas morning! Get out!"
It was the first time in his life he had ever felt such rage, and it was not pleasant. But he was outraged that the dark should have dared to interrupt this, his most precious family ritual. The rider said softly,
"Contain yourself."
In the old speech, his accent was suddenly much more marked. He smiled at Will without a flicker of change in his cold blue eyes.
"I can cross your threshold, my friend, and pass your buried holly because I have been invited. Your father, in good faith, asked me to enter the door, and he is the master of the house, and there is nothing you can do about that."
"Yes, there is," Will said.
Staring at the rider's confident smile, he focused all his powers in an effort to see into his mind, find what he intended to do there. But he came up sharp against a black wall of hostility, unbreakable. Will felt this should not be possible, and he was shaken. He groped angrily in his memory for the words of destruction with which, in the last resort, but only the very last resort, an old one might break the power of the dark. And the Black Rider laughed.
"Oh, no, Will Stanton," he said easily. "That won't do. You cannot use weapons of that kind here. Not unless you wish to blast your whole family out beyond time."
He glanced pointedly at Mary, who stood unmoving next to him, her mouth half open, caught out of life in the middle of saying something to her father.
"That would be a pity," the rider said.
Then he looked back at Will, and the smile dropped from his face as if he had spat it away, and his eyes narrowed.
"You young fool. Do you think that for all your gift of gramarye, you can control me? Keep your place. You are not one of the masters yet. You may do things as best you can contrive, but the high powers are not for your mastering yet. And nor am I."
"You are afraid of my masters,"
Will said suddenly, not knowing quite what he meant, but knowing it was true. The rider's pale face flushed. He said softly,
"The dark is rising, old one, and this time we do not propose that anything shall hinder its way. This is the time for our rising, and these next 12 months shall see us established at last. Tell your masters that. Tell them that nothing shall stop us. Tell them all the things of power that they hope to possess we shall take from them. The grail and the harp and the signs. We shall break your circle before it can ever be joined. And none shall stop the dark from rising."
The last words keened out in a high shriek of triumph, and Will shivered. The rider stared at him, his pale eyes glittering. Then scornfully he spread out his hands towards the Stantons, and at once they started into life again, and the bustle of Christmas was back, and there was nothing Will could do.
"That box for," Mary said. "Mitoffin, this is our Will."
Mr. Stanton put his hand on Will's shoulder. Will said coldly,
"How do you do?" "'The compliments of the season to you, Will,'
the rider said.
"'I wish you the same as you wish me,'
Will said.
"'Very logical,'
said the rider.
"'Very pompous, if you ask me,'
Mary said, tossing her head.
"'He's like that sometimes. "'Daddy, who is that box for, that he brought?'
"'Mr. Mitoffin, not he,' said her father automatically.
"'For your mother, a surprise,' the rider said. "'Something that wasn't finished last night in time for your father to bring it home.'
"'From you?'
"'From Daddy, I think,' said Mrs. Stanton, smiling at her husband. She turned to the rider. "'Will you have breakfast with us, Mr. Mitoffin?'
"'He can't,' said Will.
"'Will?'
"'He sees I'm in a hurry.'
"'The rider said smoothly.
"'No, I thank you, Mrs. Stanton, "'but I am on the way to spend the day with friends, "'and I must be off.'
"'Mary said, "'Where are you going?'
"'North of here. "'What long hair you have, Mary. "'Very pretty.'
"'Thank you,'
said Mary smugly, "'shaking her long, loose hair back from her shoulders. "'The rider reached out "'and removed a stray hair delicately from her sleeve.
"'Allow me.' "'He said politely.
"'She's always showing it off,' James said calmly. "'Mary stuck out her tongue. "'The rider looked down the room again.
"'That's a magnificent tree.
"'A local one?'
"'It's a royal tree,' James said, "'from the Great Park. "'Come and see.'
"'Mary grabbed the rider's hand and tugged him across. "'Will bit his lip.' "'And deliberately blanked out all thought of the carnival head from his mind "'by concentrating very hard on what he was likely to have for breakfast. "'The rider, he was fairly sure, could see into the top level of his mind, "'but not perhaps the ones buried deeper than that. "'But there was no danger. "'Though the great empty box and its pile of exotic packing stood right beside him, "'the rider, surrounded by Stantons, simply peered obediently and admiringly at the ornaments on the tree.' He seemed particularly taken with the tiny carved initials from Farmer Dawson's box.
"'Beautiful,'
he said, absently twirling Mary's left-twined M, which, Will noticed vaguely, was hanging upside down. Then he turned back to their parents.
"'I really must go, and you must have your breakfasts. Will looks rather hungry, I think.'
There was a flash of malice as they looked at one another, and Will knew that he had been right about the limits of the dark seeing.
"'I'm really immensely grateful to you, Mitoffin,'
Mr. Stanton said.
"'No trouble at all. You are right on my way. Compliments of the season to you all.'
With a flurry of farewells, he was gone, striding down the path. Will rather regretted that his mother shut the door before they had a chance to hear a car's engine start up. He did not think the rider had come by car.
"'Well, my love,' said Mr. Stanton, giving his wife a kiss and handing her the box. "'There's your first tree present. Happy Christmas.'
"'Oh,' said their mother, when she had opened it. "'Oh, Roger.'
Will squeezed past his burbling sisters to have a look. Nestled on white velvet in a box marked with the name of his father's shop was his mother's old-fashioned ring. The ring he had watched Mr. Stanton checking for loose stones some weeks before. The ring that Merriman had seen in the picture he took out of Will's mind. But encircling it was something else. A bracelet made as an enlargement of the ring. Exactly matching it. A gold band set with three diamonds in the center and three rubies on either side. And engraved with an odd pattern of circles and lines and curves round them all. Will stared at it. "'Wondering why the rider should have wanted to have it in his hands. "'For surely that must have been behind the visit this morning. "'No Lord of the Dark needed to enter any house merely to see what was inside. "'Did you make it, Dad?' said Max. "'Lovely bit of work.' "'Thank you,' said his father.
"'Who was that man who brought it?' Gwen said curiously. "'Does he work with you? Such a funny name.'
"'Oh, he's a dealer,' Mr. Stanton said. "'In diamonds, mostly. Strange chap, but very pleasant. "'I've known him for a couple of years, I suppose. "'We get quite a lot of stones from his people, including these.'
"'He poked one finger gently at the bracelet.
"'I had to leave early yesterday while young Geoffrey was still tightening one setting.
and Mitoffin happened to be in the shop and offered to drop it off to save me coming back. As he said, he was coming past here this morning anyway. Still, it was good of him. He needn't have offered. Very nice, said his wife. But you're nicer. I think it's beautiful.
I'm hungry, said James. When are we going to eat?
It was only after the bacon and eggs, toast and tea, marmalade and honey were all gone, and the debris of the first present opening cleared away, that Will realized his letter from Stephen was nowhere to be found. He searched the living room, investigated everyone's belongings, crawled underneath the tree and around the waiting pile of still unopened presents, but it was not there. It might, of course, have been inadvertently thrown away in mistake for wrapping paper. Such things sometimes happened in their crowded Christmas day. But Will thought he knew what had happened to his letter, and he wondered whether, after all, it had been the chance of investigating his mother's ring that had brought the Black Rider to the house, or a quest for something else.
Before long, they noticed that snow was falling again. Gently but inexorably, the flakes came fluttering down, without once faltering. The footprints of Mr. Mitoffin, out on the path from door to drive, were soon covered over as if they had never been there. The dogs, Rack and Cy, who had asked to go out before the snow began, came humbly scratching at the back door again.
"I'm all for a white Christmas now and then," said Max, staring morosely out. "But this is ridiculous."
"Extraordinary," said his father, looking out over his shoulder. "I've never known it like this at Christmas in my lifetime. If much more comes down today, there'll be real transport problems all over the south of England."
"That's what I was thinking," said Max. "I'm supposed to be going to Southampton the day after tomorrow to stay with Deb."
"Oh, whoa, whoa," said James, clutching his chest. Max looked at him.
"Happy Christmas, Max," James said.
Paul came clomping into the living room in boots, buttoning his overcoat.
"Snow or no snow, I'm off ringing. They all bells up in Thicky Tower, don't wait for no one. Any of you heathen mob coming to church this morning?"
"The Nightingales will be along," Max said, looking at Will and James, who between them constituted about one-third of the church choir.
"That should do you, don't you think?" "If you were to perform your seasonal good deed," said Gwen, passing, "with some useful task like peeling the potatoes, then perhaps Mum could go. She does like to when she can."
The small muffled group which set out eventually into the thickening snow consisted of Paul, James, Will, Mrs. Stanton and Mary, who was, James said, unkindly but with truth, probably more interested in avoiding housework than in making her devotions. They plodded up the road, the snowflakes coming down harder now and beginning to sting their cheeks. Paul had gone on ahead to join the other ringers, and soon the tumbling notes of the six sweet old bells that hung in the small square tower began chiming through the grey whirling world around them, brightening it back into Christmas. Will's spirits rose a little at the sound, but not much. The heavy persistence of the new snow troubled him. He could not shake off the creeping suspicion that it was being sent as a forerunner of something else by the dark. He thrust his hands deep into the pockets of his sheepskin jacket, and the fingertips of one hand found themselves curling round a rook's feather, forgotten since the dreadful night of Midwinter's Eve, before his birthday. In the snowy road, four or five cars stood outside the church. There were more, usually, on Christmas morning, but few villagers outside walking range had chosen to brave this swirling white fog. Will watched the fat white flakes lie determined and unmelting on his jacket sleeve. It was very cold. Even inside the little church, the snowflakes obstinately remained, and took a long time to melt. He went with James and the handful of other choristers to struggle into surplices in the narrow vestry corridor, and then, as the bells merged into the beginning of the service, to make their procession down the aisle and up into the little gallery at the back of the small square nave. You could see everyone from there, and it was clear that the Church of St. James the Less was not Christmas crammed this year, but half full. The order of morning prayer, "As we're in this Church of England by the authority of Parliament in the second year of the reign of King Edward VI, made its noble way through the Christmas pattern, led by the rector's unashamedly theatrical bass baritone. "O ye frost and cold, bless ye the Lord, praise him and magnify him forever," said Will, reflecting that Mr. Beaumont had shown a certain wry humour in choosing the canticle. "O ye ice and snow, bless ye the Lord, praise him,
and magnify him forever. Suddenly he found himself shivering, but not from the words, nor from any sense of cold. His head swam. He clutched for a moment at the edge of the gallery. The music seemed to become, for a brief flash, hideously discordant, jarring at his ears. Then it faded into itself again, and was as before, leaving Will shaken and chilled. "O ye light and darkness," sang James, staring at him. "Are you all right? Sit down, and magnify him forever." But Will shook his head impatiently, and for the rest of the service he sturdily stood, sang, sat, or knelt, and convinced himself that there had been nothing at all wrong except a vague feeling of faintness, brought on by what his elders like to call over-excitement. And then the strange sense of wrongness, of discordance, came again. It was only once more, at the very end of the service. Mr. Beaumont was booming out the prayer of St. Chrysostom. "Who dost promise that when two or three are gathered together in thy name, thou wilt grant their requests?" Noise broke suddenly into Will's mind. A shrieking and dreadful howling in place of the familiar cadences. He had heard it before. It was the sound of the besieging dark, which he had heard outside the manor hall where he had sat with Merriman and the lady in some century unknown. "But in a church," said Will, the Anglican choir boy, incredulous. "Surely you can't feel it inside a church." "Ah," said Will, the old one, unhappily. "Any church of any religion is vulnerable to their attack. For places like this are where men give thought to matters of the light and the dark." He hunched his head down between his shoulders as the noise beat at him. And then it vanished again, and the rector's voice was ringing out alone as before. Will glanced quickly around him, but it was clear nobody else had noticed anything wrong. Through the folds of his white surplice, he gripped the three signs on his belt. But there was neither warmth nor cold under his fingers. To the warning power of the signs, he guessed, a church was a kind of no-man's land. Since no harm could actually enter its walls, no warning against harm should be necessary. Yet if the harm were hovering just outside... The service was over now, everyone roaring out, "O come all ye faithful," in happy Christmas fervour, as the choir made their way down from the gallery and up to the altar. Then Mr. Beaumont's blessing went rolling out over the heads of the congregation. "The love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Ghost." But the words could not bring Will peace, for he knew that something was wrong, something looming out of the dark, something waiting out there, and that when it came to the point, he must meet it alone, unstrengthened. He watched everyone file beaming out of the church, smiling and nodding to each other as they gripped their umbrellas and turned up their collars against the swirling snow. He saw jolly Mr. Hutton, the retired director, twirling his car keys, enveloping tiny Miss Bell, their old teacher, in the warm offer of a ride home, and behind him jolly Mrs. Hutton, a galleon in full furry sail, doing the same with limp Mrs. Pettigrew, the postmistress. Assorted village children scampered out of the door, escaping their best-hatted mothers, rushing to snowballs and Christmas turkey. Lugubrious Mrs. Horniman stumped out next to Mrs. Stanton and Mary, busily foretelling doom. Will saw Mary, trying not to giggle, fall back to join Mrs. Dawson and her married daughter, with the 5-year-old grandson prancing gaily in gleaming new cowboy boots. The choir, coated and muffled, began to leave too, with cries of "Happy Christmas and see you on Sunday, Vicar," to Mr. Beaumont, who would be giving only this service here today and the rest in his other parishes. The rector, talking music with Paul, smiled and waved vaguely. The church began to empty as Will waited for his brother. He could feel his neck prickling, as though with the electricity that hangs strongly oppressive in the air before a giant storm. He could feel it everywhere. The air inside the church was charged with it. The rector, still chatting, reached out an absent-minded hand and turned off the lights inside the church, leaving it in a cold grey murk, brighter only beside the door where the whiteness of the snow reflected in. And Will, seeing some figures move towards the door out of the shadows, realized that the church was not empty after all. Down there, by the little 12th-century font, he saw Farmer Dawson, old George, and old George's son, John, the smith, with his silent wife.
the old ones of the circle were waiting for him, to support him against whatever lurked outside. Will felt weak for a moment as